Welcome to the Global from Asia podcast, where the daunting process of running an international business from Hong Kong is broken down into straight up actionable advice. And now, your host, Michael Michelini.
Thanks, everybody, for coming back to Global from Asia. We are now at episode 27. It's been raining here for almost a whole week straight in the south of China, and we even had hail coming down on Sunday night and minor flooding. But let's go into our show. So today, we have Larry Salibra, an American businessman in Hong Kong, who's co-founder and CEO of Pay4Bugs, which is a crowdsourced software testing platform. He's been one of my personal resources to make sense of this whole Bitcoin mania, and thought it'd be a good chance to get him on the show today to explain not only about what is Bitcoin and what does it mean, but how is it applicable to businesses, especially cross-border businesses like ours and many of you guys listening today. So, you know, I'm personally just starting to kind of experiment with Bitcoin, and, you know, I think a lot of people talk about the price fluctuations and stuff, but I'm personally looking at it to pay or receive money from people around the world. So, you know, I think that's the focus of today's show. And it's also much cheaper and faster to send money from one person or a business to another person or business in totally another country, whereas banks sometimes cause longer delays and fees. So, and after this show, we're going to talk a little bit of updates about last week's Stripe petition, how many people signed, also some upcoming episode ideas. But let's just jump right into the show. Thank you. Okay. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in to another episode. We have Larry Salibra here with us today. Thanks for being here, Larry.
Thanks for inviting me, Mike.
Okay, sure. So do you want to just quickly introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yeah, I'm the co-founder of Pay4Bugs, which is a crowdsourced software testing website. I have a background in web and mobile app development. And I've been involved in Bitcoin for the past 2 years or so.
Yeah, I wish I had listened to you and some other friends earlier and gotten involved. I still don't have much exposure to Bitcoin, but well, maybe for listeners, why or how did you first hear about Bitcoin?
I heard about Bitcoin from a friend, actually, and I looked into it a little bit.
Okay, yeah, it's definitely a very kind of like still new technology, right? This whole Bitcoin. I think people have started to hear the word. I still don't think it's mainstream. Can you give listeners a quick overview of what is Bitcoin?
Bitcoin is called a cryptocurrency, which means that it uses cryptography, which is essentially a type of math to indicate where value is stored, whether or not you have control over value. And so Bitcoin is a way for you to, is a system basically that lets you send value, which most people call money, to other people without a third party intermediary.
Great. And so we'll keep this a little bit less tech, more on the business side. I know there's mining and there's other ways that people can acquire a Bitcoin, but I think for this show, we're more of a business podcast than a tech podcast. So we won't get too deep into the technical side. I think a lot of people started hearing about it when MT Gox kind of got shut down or collapsed. Do you want to give people an idea of what happened there?
So for those of you who don't know, MT Gox was probably one of the first Bitcoin exchanges. And Bitcoin exchange is a place where you can go to use your regular money, your US dollars, your British pounds, to buy Bitcoin. They were based in Japan and had been operating for several years. And they had a reputation for sort of not being the most professional organization. And they had a crash back in 2011 that had people coin the term goxed. And so when something bad happens to you, people say, oh, you've been goxed. Or when you've been cheated by or had a problem with MT Gox. So this past year, what's happened was it came to light that they had actually lost a lot of Bitcoin that was held in their accounts on behalf of customers. And the way they lost it was because their system design had problems. And so when people asked to withdraw Bitcoin, their system would send the Bitcoin, and then bad people could sort of like hack their system and then make the system think that the Bitcoins weren't sent, and the system would go and send them again. So for an account that had 100 Bitcoins, it may actually be sending out 200 Bitcoins to the person in control of that account. And so over the long term, they ended up having no Bitcoins, but owing their customers many Bitcoins.
So I think that caused a lot of distrust, or, you know, a lot of people got scared after that collapse. And I think Bitcoin was at like 1,200, I think at a high, right, a Bitcoin. And then it dropped down to about 400 or 500, and I think it's bounced up. But it's at least today, I think it's around 550 a Bitcoin. So, you know, it's still definitely less than half the high value it was before that collapse of that exchange. So we are a Hong Kong business podcast, and So MT Gox was in Japan. Maybe you can explain about like countries, locations, and exchanges, because maybe what exchanges you know of in Hong Kong, and kind of like as a business use case for people.
Sure, no problem. There are two main Bitcoin exchanges in Hong Kong that I'm aware of at the moment. One is called Bitfinex, which is run by some French gentlemen. Other one is called ANX, which is more of a locally based exchange. And it actually has a physical on-the-ground presence and two ATM Bitcoin ATMs, I believe.
So I'm a user of one. Actually, Larry, you're the one that got me onto it. ANXBTC.com is the one I use. And I opened it online, but then I actually funded it with their ATM, which is pretty cool. But I think just to give people more understanding, there's exchanges in like the US, there's exchanges in Europe, there's exchanges in China, there's exchanges in Japan and Singapore and Hong Kong. And I think basically the difference is the local currency and the bank accounts that you could connect to. Is that the main difference, really? I mean, besides the business practice and fees?
Yeah, the main difference is are the currencies that you can transact into the financial system to which it's connected. So really one of the main challenges for Bitcoin in its early years has been where Bitcoin intersects the traditional financial system. And that's caused a lot of sort of uneasiness among regulators because they don't really understand what Bitcoin is. And Bitcoin allows you to send large amounts of value to third parties without any going through intermediary. And that's really what has caused governments in the short term to be sort of anxious. So actually in the US, we saw a couple of early Bitcoin related businesses shut down by the US Treasury Department's Financial Money Laundering Task Force because they didn't have a proper license for running that type of business. So the main difference is what jurisdiction, what legal jurisdiction you're working under.
So if you feel comfortable, you can explain your experience. But for me, I have two accounts now. I have one on Coinbase in America and it's connected to my US bank account. And I actually I opened it successfully. I verified my email, my phone number, my bank account, my credit card, but they denied my transaction. They said that they reserved the right to reject any order for any reason. So I got an email that my Bitcoin order didn't go through and I was already asleep because it was US time. And the next day I got it. So I was not too happy. It was more of an experiment. For me personally, I'm just experimenting it. And my interest is not to make money off of the price change, but more to learn how to use it as a way to do business transactions. So that was on Coinbase in America. And I believe in Coinbase, you only can do it through an American bank account. So you have to have a US bank account to fund it. So then in Hong Kong, I took Larry's tip and I did an ANX BTC account and I opened it to verify. I can't almost forget. Well, we can put this in the show notes, but I had to give him my passport. I had to give him my bank account. And because I did it as a business account, I had to show my business license from Hong Kong as a Hong Kong company. And then I could actually connect my HSBC Hong Kong account. So like we were just explaining, like it depends on which country your exchange is in, the currency you're trying to transact in, and others. Maybe we should also talk about China quickly. I know you have experience in China Bitcoin. What are some choices for people with China?
I haven't really used China Bitcoin exchanges in the last month or two, which in China terms is a very long time. A couple of months ago, I was using a BT China, which was it's headed by the former head of Walmart China. And it had the record as the largest Bitcoin exchange in the world by trading volume for a couple of weeks before the Chinese government put a halt to that. I believe another one is called OKCoin, and they just raised a few million US dollars in funding from a venture capitalist. Yeah.
So again, the difference with exchanges in different markets is you can take out the fund or withdraw in that currency. So for like BTC China and OKCoin, you can take out renminbi from your Bitcoin. So you can open the account, send Bitcoin there, take out RMB from your bank account, or you can take RMB, connect it, fund it, buy it. So that's the flow. And so what's really amazing is for cross-border business, right? I think cross-border businesses, like especially, I think specifically like Hong Kong or countries that deal business in multiple currencies and multiple countries can really benefit. And that's why I'm studying it so closely. I'm not trying to make money from like 550 to 1,000 or something. I'm trying to make money to do business more easily between multiple countries and currencies. So it's kind of a topic I have on my questions here is, so Bitcoin is an international payment. Can you maybe expand on your thoughts of how, you know, as an international payment processor?
Sure. One of the reasons that I was really interested in Bitcoin is actually the same reason as Mike. We, in our business, Paperbugs, we have testers that help people test their software products. So they get paid on a paperbug basis. And every month, we have to transmit their earnings to them. And our default payment option was PayPal in US dollars. And we started to running into the problem a few years ago that certain countries started picking fights with PayPal. I believe India was one of them. I think the Ukraine, I believe Pakistan as well. And they basically didn't want PayPal processing cross-border transactions. So that was a problem for us because we had people that had done good work for our customers and had earned money and it deserved to be paid. So if you look at really what the other options are, beyond PayPal, really, there's a company called Payoneer, which will issue debit cards for each of your people that you need to pay in other countries. But the fees are very, very high. So they don't, I mean, at the small level, they don't make sense. At the high level, the fees are really high. So they also don't make sense. But Bitcoin sort of allows us to pay people without regard to what their government thinks about it. Because in our view, I mean, if you do good work, you have a human right to get paid for that. So it's been really valuable for us because we can say, hey, you're in a country that for whatever reason is fighting with PayPal, but that doesn't, you don't have to worry about that. We can still pay you for the work you do.
Great. It kind of leads into my next question of PayPal. Yeah, I think PayPal kind of has been the international bank for a lot of online businesses, especially in Hong Kong. It's still kind of like the primary way I think people receive and send money besides bank transfers. And yeah, especially with your business and my business, Social Agent, and yours, Paperbugs, like paying an international transfer fee from one bank in one country to another bank in another country is pretty expensive and not feasible unless it's like, you know, I think the low for me is $25. I've heard in America for international wires, I pay $45 US for one Bank of America online transfer, bank international transfer. I think normally the average is about $35. Especially America, they always are very nervous for international wires. Like it's so strange to be sending an international wire. And so that's one choice. And PayPal seems to be like the second choice for people to do kind of cross-border international payments for small, especially for small amounts. And that's a podcast all by itself about the issues of dealing with PayPal and bank freezes and getting money out. So I know a lot of people are afraid to receive PayPal sometimes in certain cases. So when you send the money or send a Bitcoin to, say, your testers or people receiving it, do you have some kind of flow for that? Or how do you prepare them for getting Bitcoin?
So for our testers, they're trying to get paid. So we sort of assume that like if you choose the Bitcoin payment option, you're going to figure out how to do it in your own. From our perspective, we ask, like the way it works is that you need to come up with a Bitcoin address, which you can sort of think of as your bank account. And you need to enter that address on our site. And then we send Bitcoins to that address. And so how the other person gets an address is really up to them. One option for them is to download the original Bitcoin software. Another option is to download or open a wallet on a different website or an app on their phone.
So I finally started playing with this too, so I can explain my experiences. So an address is a very long, I don't know if you know the number. It's a very long like digital number. But I guess it's a unique number that's kind of like an email address almost, right? So I send it from my account to your Bitcoin number. And that's, some people will stick it on their blogs now, or they say, oh, tip me if you like me. I've seen people put their Bitcoin address. So you got to get that. And like Larry's saying is you have to get that from a wallet, or an exchange will also give you a Bitcoin number. I haven't.
Exchanges will also give you a Bitcoin address. I mean, it's important to understand what exactly a Bitcoin address is. It can get a little technically complicated. If you're familiar with public key cryptography, like a Bitcoin address is sort of like your public key. And then there's actually something called the private key, which is usually not displayed on your software or in the wallet. But the private key is like a password that only you, the owner of the address, should know or should have control over. And when you have that private key, you can spend the Bitcoins that are sent to that address. So if you're using an exchange, and this is where the problem came with Mt. Gox. When people sent Bitcoin to Mt. Gox, they sent it to an address that Mt. Gox gave them, but Mt. Gox kept the private key for that address. So the user, the account holder didn't actually control that address. So Mt. Gox was able to spend those Bitcoins and control them, which is actually what the customer wanted because they wanted to exchange Bitcoins. But the risk of that is that like when you don't control the private key of your address, then you don't own the Bitcoins. Anybody, the person that has the key can spend them. So you actually, to answer your question, you can actually, there's a mathematical formula you can use essentially to calculate, to generate a key pair, like an address and a private key. That's exactly what software and websites do. They don't. There's no central database of which addresses have been used or not used. Like, mathematical properties are used to generate one.
Okay. So I think with his deep technical understanding and my like more like traditional business understanding, hopefully everybody can understand. So I'm gonna say what I understand is, I think for the normal user, unless you're like a really tech guru, is you're probably gonna get a wallet address. And you can download the Bitcoin app on Android. Actually, iPhone or Apple bans Bitcoin, right?
They have approved one yesterday. Currently, as of when we're recording this podcast, I believe there's only one Bitcoin wallet approved by Apple on the App Store, but they've required the developer to disable the ability to send Bitcoins. So really, it's just a way to see your account balance, and I believe you can receive them.
Yeah, exactly. We're recording this about end of March 2014 for anybody listening later. Probably a lot of this will have changed by then. So yeah, Apple is, I guess Larry just told me, has finally one app. When I knew it, they didn't have any apps. So in Android, they don't regulate it. So I have a Bitcoin wallet in my Android phone. And then I get a QR code or I get the address number. And then I can send it to people, the public key. And then they can send me money. And then I'll get it's almost like real time. I'll get a notification on my phone that I have this Bitcoin in my account. And then I can use that wallet in my phone app to actually buy a coffee. I guess Silicon Valley probably definitely has these, but most places still don't really accept Bitcoin. But the idea is like you can use your phone to like show the QR code and scan it and buy a coffee. But so the wallet can also be used to buy things. And then, of course, you have your exchange. Exchange will have a number. I got to figure that out, actually, in ANX. I couldn't figure that out. But most likely, you'll probably have a wallet. And then you can send it from a wallet to an exchange, then withdraw from an exchange. So hopefully that makes it a little bit clear. We'll go through some more questions, and hopefully people listening can get a better understanding, because I still think it's a pretty new concept. So yeah, it kind of leads to the next question. So where should people keep their Bitcoin? I think there's the wallet and there's an exchange. Where should somebody, like, if they're going to maybe invest or speculate or trade Bitcoin, where do you kind of guide them?
Okay, if you're looking to hold Bitcoin for the long term, the safest place for you to keep it is what's called cold storage. And what that means is that you generate an address, and like an address where only you have the private key, and then you print off that private key somehow. Like it's often called a paper wallet. A site like Blockchain can help you do that. We'll put that in the show notes. And then so you take that information, you print it out, maybe you make a copy of it and you put it in two different safe deposit boxes in a real bank. Or you put it in a safe, or you put it somewhere where you're not going to lose it and no one else is going to steal it. You don't want to store it on your computer, because there's the possibility that like perhaps it'll get a virus and it'll get stolen and you won't even know it. So that's the best place to hold it for long term. If you're going to hold it for short term, you really want to, trust is still very important if it's held on a site where you don't own the private key. So if you're holding an exchange, you want to make sure you trust that exchange, because they have your money like any bank.
So like I think some of the founders, some of these exchanges put their face right on the site. Actually, I've talked to some people at ANX. I've been to their office. You know, I think when people talk about MTGOX collapsing, which is based in Japan, you know, I think that, of course, some people can question, did those get stolen or did they get lost or did they get misplaced? Basically, like if you're going to have your life savings in Bitcoin, which probably is pretty risky to do in the first place because it's still very volatile, but you should not leave it on the exchange, I think, is one of the first things. Like use that as a trading post, kind of to get money from one person or entity to another person or entity. Don't use it to hold the funds there. Use it to get it from one person or to another.
You can actually do that directly.
And you can even do that directly. See,
exchanges to... The best way to use exchanges are to get your money in and out of other currencies. So you have US dollars, you want Bitcoin, you go to exchange. You have Bitcoin, you need euros, you go to an exchange. If you're just sending Bitcoin to a company or merchant that accepts Bitcoin, or you're sending it to a friend, relative, employee, then you can send it directly. There's really no reason to involve a third party.
So my next question is, one that maybe people should really listen to, hopefully this hasn't gotten too technical or kind of kept people interested. But here's like, I wanted to kind of like maybe use, go through some daily use cases of using Bitcoin. So Larry, you've mentioned a little bit already about paying some of your bug testers. Do you want to just kind of go through them step beginning to the end of like a normal use for you or for a person? And then I could also, I have some use cases too. So I think maybe this will help put some more context to people.
Okay, sure. Well, I mean, for us, paying testers with Bitcoin is really quite simple. We generally purchase them on an exchange, and then we usually send them to like our own copy of the Bitcoin software that we run on one of our own computers. And then we just go through and look at each tester's address, and we enter that address and send Bitcoins. There's a button that says send. You put the address in, put the number of Bitcoins, hit send. The network immediately, like a message is sent out to the network. Then you can verify through third-party sites whether or not the transaction has been approved by the network. And so there's no central entity that approves it. Like all these other computers on the network look at your transaction, they do some math on it and calculations, and then they decide whether or not you were the guy that actually owned that address and could spend those coins.
So I can explain my use case. I'm pretty excited. It worked. I finally tested. It's been a couple of weeks for me to kind of get accounts open and figure out which ones to use. So I'm trying to do my Bitcoin through my Hong Kong companies. I'm trying to do most of my transactions through Hong Kong, which still is a little bit of a struggle sometimes with merchant accounts and others, which we have on other episodes. But so here what I did is I have an ANX account, and then I connected my HSBC Hong Kong account, and actually I funded it through, well, I funded it two different ways. So I'll do it. The first way I funded it was from an ATM. So people follow me on like Twitter, Instagram. You can see I put 500 Hong Kong dollars, which is about a little bit less than 100 US. And they went into their ATM in Wan Chai at their office on the 7th floor. And then it sucked it in, and then it posted to my account within like, I think about a minute. And then they said I could withdraw it or send it within like, I want to say like 30 minutes. So I couldn't use it right away, but I think I had 30 minutes for it to kind of like settle in my account. So that's one. And then you can put it to a wallet or send it to somebody, withdraw it as Bitcoin. And so that's just one. Is I only did it for like $100. I'm going to try to use that to buy stuff or to do things with. I've already lost money on that. I bought it $630 and it's at $550 as of today. But we'll see where the price goes.
Well, thanks to the IRS, you can write that off now.
Yeah, so we'll get into the IRS later. So the second use case was for business. Actually, I had to pay somebody. I won't disclose people's names just because maybe they don't want to know. My name's all over this podcast. But so he's a little bit hesitant to receive Bitcoin and because of volatility and how to use it. But he was willing to experiment on a test amount. So it was about $150 US payment. So I took $200 from my HSBC to the ANX, and then they gave me a reference number. So I first had to go to ANX. I had to say, I'm going to fund this amount, $200. So it says send $200.22. So I guess it made a little bit different so that it would know exactly how much was coming in when it saw it. And then they gave me a reference number, which is like a 8-digit number. And I put that reference number into my HSBC transaction. And for other people listening to all these shows, you know, we talk about HSBC being very easy from HSBC Hong Kong to HSBC Hong Kong. So they had an HSBC Hong Kong account. So there's no fee, same day transfer. And then I'd email them a receipt when I paid it. So I just copy pasted my HSBC Hong Kong receipt, and then I sent it to their email address, like payments@anxbtc.com. And they reply within like 10, 15 minutes, said, well, it's funded, just posted your account. So I think it started at 10 a.m. to start, and then that was like 10:30 about. I got that, and then I asked. I already had the address of the person I was paying, so I went to withdraw Bitcoin. Well, actually, I had to buy Bitcoin on dollars, so I funded it with U.S. dollars from HSBC Hong Kong, and then I converted it to Bitcoin. So I bought about as much as we figured out how much Bitcoin to pay him at that exact rate because it's volatile, and then we transferred it. And then actually, ANX sent me an email. I didn't know. And it actually went to my spam. But I had to check my spam box. And I had to click a link to authorize this within 15 minutes or else they would cancel the withdrawal. So I guess this woman is safety. Clicked the link, and then it posted to his Bitcoin wallet. He's actually still holding Bitcoin to this day, the person. And he's trying to open up an exchange in China to withdraw RMB because he's in China. So he's going to probably open up a BTC China or an OKCoin account, connected to his bank account, and then withdraw it. So that's just a use case of somebody receiving it, and then they go to their exchange. If they can still hold the Bitcoin if they want to speculate it, or you know, and see if it goes up or down, they can hold the Bitcoin or they can withdraw it. So that's kind of a daily use. So this next question is actually news I just learned with Larry before we started. Is just last night, China time, but daytime yesterday in the U.S., the IRS has kind of issued some updates of how they treat Bitcoin. So I think Larry knows this better than me, and he'll explain that.
Sure, yeah. Yesterday, the IRS issued guidance to American taxpayers that for tax purposes, they're going to treat Bitcoin as property, which means that you're liable for capital gains or capital losses on your Bitcoin.
So then I get a tax write-off on my... I still didn't realize gain, right? But I bought at 630 and now I'm at like 550. So if I withdraw U.S. dollars again, I could write that off. That's basically...
I'm not entirely familiar with capital gains write-offs, but like the basic idea is if you bought a dollar's worth of Bitcoin today and 4 days from now it went up to worth $4 US and you use that $4 of Bitcoin to buy a $4 coffee, that you would have to pay tax on $3 worth of capital gains, which is probably could be around 30% or more, depending if it's long or short term.
Yeah, something I have to worry. I'm a U.S. passport holder, an American citizen, so this does affect me and any other American in the U.S. or outside of the U.S. for our taxes. So, of course, this more regulation means a little bit more complexity in how we use Bitcoin. But I'm still very excited about Bitcoin or cryptocurrency, maybe, because we didn't talk about other ones, but there's Litecoin and there's a bunch of other Bitcoin kind of competitors or substitutes coming out. But definitely doing international business. Anybody trying to do cross-border business, I think, should definitely keep an eye out for Bitcoin. And you don't have to speculate in it. You could just take it in and send it out. So, you know, a lot of people are worried about the volatility. Actually, some people won't accept Bitcoin from me. I'm trying to pay people in Bitcoin, but they are still nervous about it. So, okay, Larry, well, what's some ways people, if they want to reach out to you or contact you, Twitter or email, or what would you like to share with us today?
Oh yeah, you can find me on Twitter, Larry Salibra, LarrySalibra.
Yeah, Twitter's great and real time. So I think that's all I have for today. And thanks for being with us, Larry. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Okay, and that's a wrap. So thanks for that, Larry. Hopefully this will give some good starting points for listeners on how to get involved with Bitcoin. I'm also still personally trying to kind of get my whole mind around all of it. And I'll keep studying it. Maybe we'll do some follow-ups in future episodes. So for last week's Stripe, we're begging Stripe to come here. We just checked the petition and there's 14 people that signed up so far. Appreciate it. Thank you guys for signing up. I know there's more people out there interested, so hopefully we can get a little bit more numbers there. Or maybe if you don't want to sign a petition, shoot an email or let me know somehow so that we can present all of this to them. And next, over the past week, I've gotten quite a lot of emails from listeners making me really excited about the future of the show. And one of the hottest topics people are asking about is third-party fulfillment from Hong Kong and warehousing. I've also, even before this podcast, have had a lot of people asking about that. So I've been working on a list. And then I also want to give a shout out to Victor Leal. He has been talking to me back and forth in the email. He's a listener on the show. And he did some research himself, so he sent me part of an extensive research report that he made for himself. So I'll use that also in that episode. I'm not going to promise for next week. It might take me a couple of weeks to get all this together, but I'm definitely excited to, and I'm glad you guys have given me good feedback. Other shows people are asking me about is like cross-border between mainland China from Hong Kong for both products, importing, exporting, you know, receipts, stuff like that. That's been a hot topic. Also HR, recruiting, payroll, stuff like that. I'm working on that too. So thanks guys for listening and a lot more coming up. Thank you.
To get more info about running an international business via Hong Kong, please visit our website at www.globalfromasia.com. That's www.globalfromasia.com. Also, be sure to subscribe to our iTunes feed. Thanks for tuning in.